Season 8, Episode 12, the final episode in this season. Jumping Castles and Dust Devils. Warning, this episode includes discussion about fatal events impacting children and families. We advise listener discretion. The Y-Work team, Alan, Trage and Sarah, discusses the complexities of a prosecutorial strategy when fatal events happen at a school, children who die as a result of a windstorm and out-of-control airborne jumping castle. Those involved in the work design include a jumping castle supplier, the workplace host, a school, and an overseas manufacturer. Trage delves into legal concerns. There are concurrent, non-delegable duties, he says, with distinct but interconnected duties and responsibilities from the design, manufacturer, supplier, and distributor. Listen to the podcasters debate this delicate and complex topic, and this is an extra long final episode for this season.
Track about the unanswered questions, a tale of life's trials and tribulations. I work towards better days, better pays, steering clear the trap of old ways.
Hello and welcome to the Y-Work podcast, a series of playful legal dissections on the most curious and alarming events in the world of work. The podcasters Alan Girl, Trage Svetkovsky and Sarah Pazell debate how to craft a better experience of work. Sit back, relax and enjoy. And remember, none of the things we talk about today should be construed as legal advice or any other type of advice. We're just here to talk about all things related to work.
As you know, we dedicate quite a number of hours or episodes to recreational activities and how when things can go awry and suddenly something that was supposed to be the best day ever turns into an absolute tragedy. Currently, I cannot think of anything more, I guess, traumatic than the events that occurred in Tasmania with respect to the jumping castle and the death of all those children.
And can we just pause? Because when you say the word recreation, we've talked about recreation outside the workplace among workmates that has gone awry. We've talked about recreation that has gone awry, and it's recreation for the public attendees or the customers, but it's not recreation for everybody in the ecosystem. Others in the ecosystem have a workplace, you know, whether they're running four-wheel drive cruises out on the beach or whether they're operating children's events at a school carnival, that's their workplace, right?
Yep.
They're paid, they're remunerated, they've got functions to do, whether it's Dream World and you're a ride operator, it's your workplace.
Yeah, so this is more in the context of the public safety aspect, the attendees, the patrons. So a bit
patrons
like Dream World.
Patrons are general public, right? Going for fun. It's their recreation, but it's other people's workplace that must adhere to workplace standards for what they do for their colleagues and for the service they deliver. Okay.
Yeah. But today we're going to talk about the very widely publicized, and the decision just came out recently with respect to the fatality of those patrons. And I can't, in terms of the calendar of tragedy and sadness, I can't think of anything worse than six children dying.
And two injured.
Yes, and remember we talked about the volcano in New Zealand erupting, 22 people died. So, Alan, I know you've recently read the decision. Talk us through that case.
Yeah, I think the decision's an enormously important one, and perhaps potentially it could change the way we think about work health and safety. Before I do, because I'll talk about it in a very clinical way, I want to acknowledge that enormous tragedy with those six children. I can't think of another case in my career where there's been so much pain for families. And so I just acknowledge that. All right, so what happened was the school, it was a state school, Hillcrest, it was holding an event and it wanted to have some entertainment for the children, and it engaged a woman, Rosemary Gamble, to provide a bouncing castle and an enclosure for Zorb balls. Now, the enclosure, the two kids that were injured were in Zorb balls. But the case isn't really about the Zorb balls. It's all about this jumping castle.
And explain what a Zorb ball is.
It's a blow-up ball that the kids can be inside and roll around. And because they're inside this blow-up ball, it provides a measure of protection. And they were...
Some insulation.
Yeah, yep. Because, so there's some sort of buffer. But with the jumping castle, the children fell out of the jumping castle as it was airborne. So it was a fall from heights. And
it was airborne because...
There was a thing called a dust devil, and it's a real thing, dust devils. They're a bit like a mini tornado. This dust devil had a diameter of 4 metres, so that gives you the idea of the size. But they're incredibly powerful, and this one had the power to lift a small car.
Wow. Wait, so, wow.
Yeah.
Right.
And they're also incredibly unpredictable, and it was a beautiful, calm day, sunny day, and the weather forecast gave no indication whatsoever, and this dust devil came out of nowhere. And not only was it incredibly unpredictable that the dust devil would form, but it was also very unpredictable that it would go almost directly over the top of the jumping castle. Now, to understand the decision, you need to know a bit of the history. And the Ms. Gamble bought... She's a sole trader. She started business with a loan from her mother for $5,000, and she bought this jumping castle from a supplier in Sydney who had sourced the jumping castle from a manufacturer in China. There were some issues there about the manufacturer in China which aren't central to the decision, but just to briefly touch on them, the manufacturer said that it was built to Australian standards and there was evidence to suggest that it was not. The supplier didn't supply it with 8 pegs, supplied it with 4, and the 4 pegs didn't meet Australian standards.
I didn't realise it was from the supplier's end. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And also we have to remind our listeners that in terms of supplier, manufacturer, designer, installer, all of these concurrent, non-delegible duties, you're tied in.
Yep.
Elaborate.
So what? It's not just the person conducting the business or undertaking, in this case, the woman you've mentioned. There are duties, and these are distinct but interconnected responsibilities that are imposed on various duty holders. Mm. They can be those who have manufactured it. They can be those who have installed, designed, and so on and so forth. The duties provisions allow for that. So that's a really important aspect of this case.
So just while you're on that point, the decision of charging was the decision of the Tasmanian DPP,
yep,
or Director of Public Prosecutions. And they chose to charge Miss Gamble and charged her with a Category 2 offence. I'll come back to that. Had they charged her with a Category 3 offence, she would have been found guilty, applying the reasoning of the magistrate. Mm. They didn't charge the school, which was fascinating because the magistrate made a statement with unintended consequences, I believe. The magistrate said the school did nothing. I think when the magistrate made that statement, he meant to say the school had no responsibility because it didn't contribute to the accident. But the school, as the controller of the premises and the person that engaged Ms. Gamble, did have responsibilities, and the fact that he said they did nothing begs the question of why they weren't charged. I don't know the answer to that question. And the manufacturer weren't charged.
And I think we need to pause in that because we've talked a lot about, for example, mine sites and hosting new equipment on their site and who's responsible. Is it the statutory engineers for checking that things are compliant? Is it the suppliers who's checking that it was compliant? You know, whatever for standards of the operations.
Well,
so
yeah.
I think for...
That's right.
I think what you're saying, the connotation is there that the school knew the intent and purpose. So did they have a checklist to verify?
No,
that
the school had nothing.
Right, but I think that's what you're implying, is that, hang on, was there an obligation, a duty or responsibility to know who's doing what service that impacts.
Well, that's right. In fact, just remember, with one of the gate case failures, I think at one point I had up to 12 potential duty holders, and we narrow those down based on the evidence that's available. So as we know in the legislation, there are various provisions which says you can't transfer or there are concurrent duties. So I'm quite surprised by what you've just said, that the school was, as the word the investigators would use, out of scope. I'm quite surprised by that. But anyway, be that as it may.
So the school only had to do what was reasonably practicable. But when the magistrate says the school did nothing, it sounds as though it would be easy to make out a charge against the school because they'd done nothing. Okay, so then Miss Gamble gets her bouncy castle, and when it's supplied to her, it's supplied with four pigs, and the bouncy castle had eight holes for the pigs. Now, there's a lot of debate about that. Miss Gamble, when she gets the bouncy castle with four pigs, thinks, well, that must be for normal operation. I use four pigs in normal circumstances, and where it's a windy day, I'd use more than four. And so that was her state of mind. She wasn't supplied a manual, but there were two types of documents that were loosely called manuals that came with the bouncy castle. Neither was provided. Only one of them provided any sort of information about the number of pegs you should use. Anyway, the prosecution called an expert who said that if the bouncy castle had been used with eight pegs, Miss Gamble only used four, it would have been able to resist the force of the dust devil. Ms. Gamble produced an eminently qualified expert, and he said that it would have, I think I might stand corrected on this, but I think he said 80 pegs. We would need 80 pegs to hold the castle down, and there were only eight holes. Now, the magistrate came somewhere in the middle and said, I accept that eight pegs would not have been enough to hold the castle down, but
so even with eight pegs, as specified by the designer, it would not have been adequate. It would have been inadequate.
Correct.
So then we get to design obligations to test all the scenarios.
Yeah. So then we get down to the reasoning of the magistrate, the legal reasoning. The magistrate said, Ms. Gamble has a duty, unsurprising. And she has to do all that's reasonably practicable. There were eight holes in the jumping castle for eight pegs, and she only used four. It was reasonably practicable for her to use eight pegs. And, in fact, she had the eight pegs on her. So, or her workers had the eight pegs on them. And then it gets to the really interesting thing, which is the ground-changing point, which is the decision of the magistrate.
Can I just pause on that? That was an that's a good – the ground-changing point.
Yep.
Has it changed its birthing function?
It's changed the way I've thought about work health and safety.
No, I'm talking literally.
Well, just on that point, there was some evidence that the bouncy castle flew 16 metres into the air. 62 or 64 metres horizontally.
Imagine seeing your child in there.
16 metres is very high.
Very high.
Wow.
So, if a child...
My little fur on my arm just went up, right?
If a child felt a metre, you'd be scared.
No, that's right.
Well, high risk after 16 metres. Yeah.
After 2 metres, it's high risk work activity, isn't it?
And how many cases have you had where someone survived a 16-metre fall?
But I have had a case involving a strong gust of wind, which I'll talk about, involving a school student.
Oh, okay. All right. We'll come to that.
Yeah.
Let's get down to the legal reasoning. So the magistrate said, I am satisfied that Ms. Gamble had a duty.
Yep.
I am satisfied that she didn't do all that was reasonably practicable and she had an obligation to ensure the safety of those children. Okay. Therefore, she hasn't fulfilled her duty.
Right.
That's what you need to do to get over Category 3 offence.
Mm.
But to get over Category 2 offence, which is what she was charged with, you have to say not only was there a breach of duty, but the breach of duty exposed someone to the risk of death or injury.
Right. So slow back. Go backwards for me again. So breach of duty, there's a breach of duty. But if to me, isn't there a breach unless it's about exposing somebody to harm?
Well, there's categories. I was mentioning the lowest, like a simpliciter, like a simple.
No, hold on. Let me address that, because that's what the case is all about.
Yeah. Right.
As a professional looking at the case, this is what you'd be focused on. So, yes, she could have, what the magistrate, in lay terms, what the magistrate was saying was she could do more, right? She could have done more. She could have put 8 pegs in.
Mm.
And he was saying that was what was reasonably practical because the bouncy castle was designed for
to
8
have pegs. 8. And, but the implication is obviously to hold it down, to save it from flying away and causing harm of fatal hazard exposures or disablement or injury.
Yeah, that to exposure. The moment you introduce expose,
it's the word exposure.
I know, but to me, so what doing more if there's not an exposure to something? Hello, those go hand in hand, right? They're coupled.
Because
I know what you're saying.
Yeah. He found.
Layman logic, it makes no sense unless it's coupled with exposure.
I'll help you get over that.
Right.
So
Let me see if you can.
He said. These are not his exact words, but this is what he's saying. He's saying the dust devil is at another level altogether. If she'd used 8 pegs, the bouncy castle still would have taken off, and the 6 children still would have died.
Yes.
So even if she'd done,
can we just pause and just give some respect to the gravity of that?
Yeah, it's
6
terrible.
Children have died, right? Yeah. That's huge.
So Alan, before you continue, in the evidence, are these rare weather events?
They are. Well, there's a few things that are rare.
Are they foreseeable?
Well, first of all, bouncy castles being affected by the wind is not rare. That happens every time you're outdoors.
Yeah.
Right.
Bouncy castles being made airborne is rare, but happens with sufficient frequency that it's well known.
It's known, foreseeable.
It's known, okay.
Dust devils are sort of a similar thing where they're rare, they're very unpredictable, but they're known. They're known to happen.
And in this area was Tassie?
So they have dust devils, and in Queensland you talk about whirly-whirlies, which are much smaller.
Whirlwinds, yes. But I guess that's for me really important.
A hurricane or something?
Well, no, we don't. Yeah, but no. We just get whirly winds.
It's like a tornado. It's like a mini
tornado. I've seen one out in the ocean at Coolum Beach.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
So because obviously I know the outcome of the case, but this idea of freak events, and I'll get to my case 10 years ago because that was a central issue about the freak event. But I'm still curious. Could you compare, for example, the dust devil to the prospects of a meteorite landing on your work site?
Well, you could, and I think the moral of the story is you're not responsible for everything.
Yes.
Right? So if you have a duty and you breach your duty because you haven't done everything that's reasonably practicable, that doesn't automatically make you responsible for everything.
Yeah.
You have to, if you're charged with a Category 2 offence, or probably, he didn't rule on this, but probably Category 1 and industrial manslaughter, if you're charged with Category 2, then you're only responsible for what the exposure, the breach exposes people to.
Yes.
And what the magistrate said was the breach did not expose the children to the risk of being blown up 16 metres in the air by a dust devil.
Wow. So this is like force majeure kind of stuff. This is major, like act of God beyond your control.
But it's foreseeable. So does it go back then to the designer should have thought of this?
Like a completely cyclone-proof castle.
Well, one of the real problems with cases like this is the prosecutor wasn't willing to take on a Chinese manufacturer. And
disappointing. Let's go back because this this comes down to what my American brain goes back to commercial realities of prosecuting this, not the principles behind the prosecution.
Yeah, it was driven by commercial.
Right. Commercial reality is going to be a pain in the butt, going to take a lot of work to held them accountable. It's going to cost us a lot of money.
But let's remember what you said, 6 young
souls. I know.
Yeah, that's what I said. This is the biggest case, in my career.
So versus the principles of the case, the commercial realities, pain in the ass and costly to our firm, right? That's what I hear in this, because I think I'm very distrusting.
It's the crown, Sarah. The crown has a bottomless pit. The crown has a credit card that goes on at zero. Okay,
so that's what I'm going to get to.
It's like, the crown. The crown.
I think the evidence would have largely been the same, regardless of who was charged. There just would have been some practical issues about serving the Chinese company. It may be that the Chinese company may not have appeared.
Yeah, of course not.
But there was a New South Wales supplier.
Yeah, someone supplied it. Someone's imported
it. That's right. There's a funnel. Supply chain funnel.
And the legislation is clear about that. Yeah. You can do it. We've done workshops in New South Wales with design, etc.
Yes, we've talked about this.
You don't always have to hang your hat on section 19.1 or 19.2. There are things like 20 and 21 and 22 of the work of the
system. If people are trying to make sense of this, can I just pause for a moment? People are trying to make sense of, well, what improvements would I make in my workplace, right, or in my situation? Three things they should look up. TRLs, CRLs, and HRLs. Technology readiness levels, commercial readiness levels, and human readiness levels. And the one thing that we've talked about at a recent mining event that's missing in those levels is ORLs, organizational readiness levels, right? And that's a lot of overlap. Someone who's very wise and knowing about, like in NASA, in the 1970s, when they looked at releasing design, developing and releasing technologies, they had to go through phases and stages of testing and development before they're more market ready, more technical use ready, right? Commercial readiness levels was about the market readiness levels to match those similar types of levels. And in 2010, there was a master's student who was looking at human readiness levels, a master's student in human factors. And from all of the issues about distributed situation awareness, some of those researchers, they started to assess, well, hang on, what do we need to know if the technology is ready that humans can actually interface with it?
Well, I think
react to it, test it progressively, and manage it in a work system.
There's a lot of things that come out of this case, but one of the things that comes out of the case, following on from what you're saying, is that sometimes the extremely rare thing can happen, and when the extremely rare thing happens, if you haven't prepared for it, then there can be an enormous tragedy, which is exactly what happened.
Again, I'm ranking these major random events, such as a meteorite landing or on you or...
I don't think that's a good analogy, because you don't have any control over media landing.
What about a dust storm?
You do have control about whether you put the bouncy castle indoors or outdoors.
Okay.
And if you put it outdoors, the way in which it's tied down to the ground.
What about the volcano occurring on the island? Where would you put
There was awareness of, do you go or do you not go?
This is really complex,
It's still pretty hard, because that testing, like if you go through the iterative testing, and I'm going to give credit to Micah Ensley, and it was one of her students. It's the human factors, cognitive work analysis, distributed situation awareness researcher. When you get to the third phase of human readiness and the ninth stage, you start looking at testing it in a variety of scenarios, like resilience engineering. What are the early alerts of a hazard? What are the ways that you'd respond? Do you have enough hazard response time? Can you test it out progressively in normal operating conditions, right? When you're looking at interfacing with technology. So from the human interface right through to the social systems and recovery for events, all of that kind of stuff, the dynamic. And that goes, if I go back to Trej and his social thoughts on law, it's about foreseeability, right? And you're telling me that it was foreseeable. I hear you saying the eight pegs wouldn't have held the damn thing down, but then who's responsible? The designer should have known this. The school should have known this, that the events they hold might have whirly burly, what do you call them? Devils.
I think everyone had devil a level dust. Of responsibility. Devil dust. It's a question of, it's not just whether you have a duty and whether or not you meet that duty. It's also about should you be found to have committed a criminal offence?
Yeah. Mm. Look, I have empathy for everybody involved, this entire ecosystem. So I'm not harshly suggesting that blame would solve things per se, right? I know that.
But it's the way the legislation's written. We have a harmonised legislation is about blame.
Yeah, and that's the judgment the causes people to take events seriously for future, right? Whether it's civil, financial, or criminal, like you're talking about, but I feel for the operators of the jumping castle. That would have been heartbreaking. Single woman, operator.
Of course,
I feel for the school. I feel for the community. I feel for the designer. Right, I do. I have empathy that knows no bounds in this case. Well, how are the parents feeling about this judgment?
Well, that's another big issue.
That's a separate issue.
Let's
turn back to the forensics.
Now, hold on. I want to touch on that issue that Sarah's just raised. And DPP had this impossible decision to make. They could have charged her with a Category 3 offence, which would guarantee that she'd get a very low fine. And then the family would be very disappointed that she'd get a very low fine. Or they could have charged her with a Category 1 offence, industrial manslaughter. It didn't exist at the time that this offence occurred, breach of duty occurred.
Within that jurisdiction,
And the chances of them succeeding with a Category 1 offence would have been low.
Mm. I don't know.
And she'd have
before
to
a jury, mate.
Before a jury, yes.
Because remember, it's a battle of experts. Their expert was, the way I understand it, they didn't like or they didn't prefer the expert of the prosecutor who said 8 pegs could have held it. They preferred the other forensic expert.
Correct.
And my experience with engineers in their reports. But anyway.
But at least if they'd chosen Category 1, they could have gone to the family and said,
correct,
we're calling her to account on an offence that carries a jail sentence.
Before a jury.
So at least the family would have known that that it was deserving of the most serious of offences.
Well, for me, I just see this as 31 through and through.
Mm. Explain that.
Oh, Section 31, reckless conduct. Yes. Before a jury, Sections 32 and 33 are done in the magistrate's court.
Okay.
So it's the arbiter of law, in fact, is the magistrate or the judge, depending on the jurisdiction. But when you get to a reckless prosecution or industrial manslaughter, those triers of fact, the ones who are going to listen to the story,
evaluate
the jury.
Jury, the human element, the optics, the emotion.
Correct.
The mushroom killer kind of.
Yeah, the jury. Expect. Correct. The jury. Mushroom, the Aaron Patterson case.
Right.
So I wonder, forget 33. I'd never, let's get back and go, that'd never be on the table. 32, yes.
I had thought at the beginning that 32 was a mistake. Very sympathetic to DPP in terms of, you know, it's perfectly understandable why they chose that charge.
Okay.
But I think the trick is you've got to say to the family up front,
families.
And it would have been a very big cohort. I mean, you're probably talking 60 plus people.
Yeah, when you look at the
extended
family. You'd
never begin to imagine the trauma. It would be like rolling in hundreds of victim impact statements on the one day.
Oh.
So you would have to prepare them and say that the prospects of securing a conviction are not great.
How much counselling?
But they're going to give it your best shot.
So it's unreal.
Right.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So the one thing I just can't get past is that, as Sarah mentioned, this idea of foreseeability and what's reasonable and what's practicable, 6 peg, 8 pegs, but I'm quite intrigued by the consequences of this. Is it a devil dust or a dust devil?
Dust devil.
Just if this is known, remember, Sarah, you talk about the known and the unknowns. Mm. I wish I was a meteorologist and I wish I was living in Tasmania so I can fully appreciate what is a dust devil. And obviously.
Well, I didn't know of them until this case.
No.
Mini twisters, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but not with the strength of a dust devil.
Yeah.
Being able to lift a car, that's incredibly powerful.
Mm. That's powerful. Mm. And you know, can I just say that it's so, because for me, I always look to popular culture, and hopefully no listener will misinterpret what I'm about to say. But for those of you who are fans of Chris Lilley, We Can Be Heroes, his very first episode involved a jumping castle which flew out of the air and a police officer rescued the kids and was given Australian Order of Heroism.
Oh, there you go.
Yep. Go and watch it. It's on YouTube.
Oh,
Chris Lee's been in trouble of late with some of his other things, but his very first scene involved a Queensland police officer rescuing kids where the pegs
Popped out,
and the jumpy castle flew away with kids, and he rescued them. I'm sure it's not true.
Sure, that's been like on cartoons and things. It's kind of a thing,
except,
right?
Except bizarrely, immediately when this occurred, it's called We Can Be Heroes for those. And
We Can Be Heroes.
It's not for everyone's comedic palate.
Yes.
But isn't it extraordinary that somebody prophesied in popular culture the seriousness and the
foreseeability of this, right?
Yeah. So, again,
stay tuned because I don't think it's over. I think there's a very good chance.
Really?
That there will be a coronial inquest after. Well, I don't know if there'll be an appeal, but there'll be a coronial inquest.
I'd like to know if there's going to be an appeal.
And we could. So you would, of course, seen the stuff about Kumanjaya Walker and Zachary of Rolfe, where the coroner has just made decisions about the treatment of Kumanjaya by the police officer, shooting him three times. And so the police officer was not found guilty by a jury, so he's found not guilty in lay terms. And then there was a coronial inquest, and the coroner has been extremely critical of the police officer and the police force in general. In fact,
and the coroner's findings are really
disturbing. As an Australian, it's disturbing to read her findings.
Explain the case very quickly.
Sorry?
Because you've mentioned it. Just explain it really in a nutshell.
Oh, in a nutshell, a Northern Territory police officer who was well known for his adrenaline-powered actions burst into a house to apprehend a young man. The young man pulled a sort of a knife out, did stab the police officer in the shoulder, but wasn't a major injury. And the police officer then shot him three times.
Was and the person vulnerable that stabbed him? Was he Indigenous? Was he what?
Yes. And a young Aboriginal man.
Yep.
And there's footage of it happening, so you can, if you search online, you can see the footage. And also, I apologise for anyone who's distressed with me talking about this. The death itself is terrible, and the fact that a young man, regardless of his cultural background, gets shot in his own home is very distressing. The fact that everyone's been forced to wait years for this thing to come to some sort of end is terribly distressing. But to make the point about the jumping castles, we've got a coroner who's come to a completely different conclusion to the conclusion of the criminal process.
And it's interesting.
And so what? What happens? Now what? What's the implications?
Well, there are potentially very serious allegations. I'm not sure whether Zachary Rolfe could be charged with alternate offences.
The police officer.
Yep. The police has been embarrassed nationally, maybe even internationally, and so they should. This feels a bit like what it was like just before the Fitzgerald inquiry. So, you know, there could be a big inquiry into the Northern Territory Police.
Mm.
Right.
They were handing out...
So the entire culture, the behaviour, the governance, problems, the systemic the problems, coroner said operations.
Systemic problems.
Yeah. Right.
And as an Australian, and an Australian with Indigenous blood, I find it very disturbing that this kind of behaviour that was going on is going on at this time in our cultural development.
And I guess the coroner, it's almost like a judicial safety net in some respects, that even, so it's not the end of the matter. I mean, you can appeal all the way to the High Court. Who knows? The coroner may decide to not agree with the findings
of the magistrate.
Yeah, and could just kick off just like in the Northern Territory case. So this one's quite special for me because it brings back a case I did involving the death of a 9-year-old girl when a gust of wind, the last day of school, it was a school breakup in Bundaberg, and they'd all just settled down to have some Domino's pizza, and one of those cafe streets, you know, the streets brand.
Oh, yeah.
It's upended, it's lifted it and itself off the ground.
Ice cream, you're saying ice cream what? You mean streets. The displays?
Yeah, those cafe beach style umbrellas.
You didn't say the word umbrella?
Oh, yeah. The beach style umbrellas, the cafe style umbrellas.
Yes.
It's uplifted itself and it's blown across
the way. I remember this, yeah.
Yeah, one into the pool to the other and it struck this poor child and she died. I remember this.
Yeah, I
ended up prosecuting that, but it was very simple. It was a Section 32, much like this Jumping Castle case, and it was simply I particularised the umbrella as an item of plant and that it was unsecured. To make the matter quite complex.
Who was responsible?
Oh, the cafe? The pool.
It was a pool.
So as the PCBUs. So what was fascinating about that case was there were a number of these beach-style cafe umbrellas, like six or so. You know, they're big. Big enough to kill somebody. Some of them had been secured with those special pins that, go in on the bottom.
Mm.
And unfortunately, some of them hadn't been secured. Now, the weather conditions, just like in Tasmania, were fine. However, this was on the Friday, last day of school, but about a Monday or the Tuesday, a couple of teenagers were at the pool sunbaking and there was a gust of wind and the umbrella, well, not necessarily that umbrella, but an umbrella at that same workplace flew out and nearly struck them.
So they were quite past worried. History of knowing this foreseeability right then. Mm. Right.
So a couple of days, there's a bit of wind. Now,
recent.
So that in itself was unusual because it was December and so whilst, Bundaberg is known for its tropical cyclones, etc., this was just in the middle of the day, and I remember, so this occurred, so it landed on my desk, and I remember asking the investigator, can you just find out how often do freak gusts of winds occur and just kill somebody? And he did. He came back. He said, the last time a beach-style cafe umbrella uplifted itself and struck somebody and killed them was in 1943 in Venice Beach, California.
1943.
That was the last time. So this is the year 2013.
So what happened to that defendant?
He pleaded guilty.
Right. Interesting.
So, and that's why I have a special interest in this case.
They pleaded guilty. And did that diminish their...
Oh, yeah, mitigation, of course. Which is always good. Don't get me wrong, that's good.
Yeah.
But you're before the court.
Yes.
So I have a special interest in the way in which... So first of all, the particulars around the case.
You didn't win that trade. They gave it to you when they pleaded guilty.
He positioned it. You were a good prosecutor.
I didn't call it an umbrella. I called it an item of plant.
Yeah. From layman listening to this, what I hear you saying is that a good prosecutor puts all the chess pieces in place where you wouldn't have any other strategy other than to say, it'll be better if I just plead guilty here. And that's what you're saying. What's the strategy around presenting and preparing the prosecution?
No pun intended, but the devil's in the detail. And
can we just take a segue off that?
I Googled it.
Because Miss Gamble is very interesting because she had no exposure to a jail sentence. With a Category 2 offence, the only thing she would ever get would be a fine, and the fine was... If she'd pled guilty, she would have got a fine that was probably about 20% of a legal cost. So far, far cheaper to plead guilty.
Right.
Far
so cheaper. Symbolic, wouldn't it have helped catharsis to plead guilty?
Yes. So that must have been something that weighed on her mind too, that in terms of the families of the children, that wouldn't it make it easier for them if she pled guilty? But clearly it was important to her to say, if I've done the wrong thing, I didn't expose the children to the terrible tragedy that happened. And she was willing to put her money where her mouth was, and she contested it. I don't know how she afforded to contest it. It would have been astronomically expensive,
but it's
the difference, isn't it? I always find it's the contested cases that are the really interesting ones because everyone's put their best case forward and then an adjudicator has to make that decision on
historic other lawsuits, the optics, et cetera, the social constraints.
It's the strength. It's definitely this case, the one in Tasmania, does turn on the cogency of the forensic experts' evidence. It really seems to have persuaded this.
It's that word expose in the category yeah. two offence.
What have you exposed them to?
No, but without the evidence, that word exposed is pointless. It's meaningless. It means nothing.
Oh, yes,
it's got to be given life. And so clearly.
Yeah, what's the context?
The defendant's expertise in preparing that report on balance, well, not on balance, overrode anything that the prosecution offered.
And I just can't help but go, hang on, was the technology tested to be used in those types of conditions? Was it commercially ready for use in that condition at a school for a fair in that location? And human readiness, did you think about all the realities of the social systems, the children using it, their ability to respond to behaviors, the parents? That's why I go back to TRL, CRL, HRLs. Hang on. Who examined this whole system right through for ongoing applications, like realities. Like even in that twister that I talked about at Coolum Beach, right? Out in the ocean, we're going, oh, it was cool to watch. But in that, I remember that day, there was a surfer surfing right next to it, and we were all waving, saying, get away from the twister, mate. And he just thought it was cool. He wouldn't leave it. And we were like, oi, that could be really dangerous. He was surfing right near it, did not want to leave the water, right? There was enough foreseeability for even laymen who are not meteorologists to go, I think that could be a problem.
So what happened in Tasmania is after the event, the Tasmanian government said, they made a ruling that there were going to be no more outdoor bouncing castles at any school.
Extreme, right?
Well, maybe they took the same view as you and they said, the science just isn't here yet.
That's not my view.
We need to.
That's not my view.
Well, they said, look, it just hasn't been tested. We don't have the veracity of testing to say whether or not these things
can be safe. I get so frustrated then when people put this one thing happens, rule, blank rule, without understanding scenario analysis.
What was it, the TRL?
The whole risk management. But we're just shutting it all down. Yeah. No more fun, people.
But I can't put your acronyms aside. But if you did all your testing, would you have foreseen a dust devil? Playing devil's advocate here.
Well, you're just telling me that it was foreseeable that these happen in Tasmania.
But with all your rigorous, with your fancy acronyms there, would you have included
the dust? It's not me, Sarah Pizzell.
Listen,
working with multidisciplinary teams who have knowledge in the weather, the conditions, what we're doing, you know. Again, four pegs does not sound like a lot. Right? So even that, you'd be testing like, hang on, what?
That's right. But would
I'm going
be
back
enough?
To the designer. I'm going even back to the designer to
right.
say, was there a disclosure that this should not be used in which kind of conditions? Yeah. Please check this. Is there, you know, obligation?
I think the manufacturer, who was also the designer.
Who's this Chinese manufacturer, in Tasmania.
It was unresponsive.
Right. Yes, so, that's what I'm getting at, right? Hang on a minute.
It's tricky. It is
but
hard.
I think that from an OHS professional's perspective, take 10 minutes to think about, you know, what if the unpredictable happened? Let's think about what are those very rare things and let's take 10 minutes to think about them.
Can I say for the OHS professional, host a forum, a multidisciplinary focus group to analyze this among subject matter domain experts, right? Don't expect it's all on your shoulders that you would know all this, and have a focus group, a design readiness evaluation on its use, the reality of use, right? And that's what you were doing retrospectively in trying to examine, has this ever happened before, right?
That's the thing, like, you know, okay, it says eight. Yeah, look, I do understand the logic that the magistrates applied and adopted, but for me, I just can't reconcile how common were these.
Well, as a professional, if it went on appeal on that issue, that would be very interesting to see what the appellate court said.
Yes.
It's not the first time the argument's been run. I've seen the argument run quite a few times in New South Wales, but this is the first time where it's been so obvious that's the basis upon which the decision was made.
And I guess the sheer gravity of the social cost of this event.
Imagine the poor magistrate. So impossible to reach a conclusion. You know, it would have been an incredibly tense courtroom.
If it was a finding of guilt, whether the matter would have been appealed.
And appealed.
That's the nature of the adversarial system. We will speculate But anyway, yeah. That's probably the saddest thing we've heard.
We hope you enjoyed that episode of Why Work. You've been listening to Trage, Sarah and Alan. And if you'd like to know more about some of the things we've talked about today, please subscribe and we'd be more than happy to provide you with information, names of cases and other things that may interest you. Please be aware that none of the matters we've talked about today should be construed as legal advice or any other type of advice. We're just here to talk about all things related to work. See you next time.
This is a track about the unanswered questions, a tale of life's trials and tribulations. I work towards better days, better pays, steering clear the trap of old ways. With a clear head, navigate life like a maze, dedicated to hip-hop.